Now, I suppose if there's one theme text which will emerge as the main theme of this camp meeting's studies, it'll be that text from Revelation chapter 16 and verse 12. Revelation 16 and the 12th verse. A verse which, of course, we have read many times, but a verse which tonight I think will emerge with something like new meaning as we proceed with the series of studies which lie before us in this series of meetings. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now, I don't plan tonight to attempt to develop too much of what this verse means to us, because this will be the result of a series of studies during the coming week. I'd like to make just one or two obvious points from it tonight. And the first one is this, that here we have an event which must take place before certain subsequent other events can follow. And the event is this, that the water of the river Euphrates must be dried up. For what purpose? That the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now, in other words, there'll be no way for the kings of the east to come until such time as the water of this great river has been dried up. That's very obvious and plain from what this verse says. Therefore, if the way of the kings of the east has not been prepared, then the kings of the east certainly cannot come until such time as this drying up of this great river has taken place. Now, later in the week, of course, as we proceed with the study in a series of presentations, we're going to learn that the kings of the east, the Christ and his armies, in the glorious and wonderful second coming in the clouds of heaven. We're going to learn too that the drying up of the great river Euphrates is the drying up of all that great river of supports, both priestly and from the people in the world, which Satan is enjoying in the last days as a signal of his great and final almost success. We're going to learn that this drying up of the river Euphrates is something which is accomplished by the 144,000. And yet that's not the correct thing to say, because really it's Christ's work. He is the one that gains the victory, but the 144,000 will be the instruments through whom he will work. And we've learned in the history of the past that God cannot accomplish his purposes in this world, excepting he has human instruments through whom to work. It says back there in the book of Jeremiah and Isaiah, who will go and tell this people? And both Jeremiah and Isaiah said, here I am, Lord, send me. When God had a voice in the world, a man in the world, a messenger, then in turn the message could go with power and direction to the needy people upon the face of the earth. When there's no man, no messenger, no servant of God, as it says there also in the word of God, when there's no vision, the people perish. And so it is true that God must have instruments through whom he is going to work in order to accomplish the work that must be done. And this doesn't mean, of course, that human beings are to gain pride and self-satisfaction from this, because we shall always feel, as a true child of God, unworthy and insufficient and inefficient and very much far short of what God designed us to be. And in the end, we shall cast our glittering crowns at the feet of Jesus and acknowledge that this has been his victory and his work through to the end. But at the same time, let's not overlook the fact that the people of God must accomplish a certain work upon this earth before the end can come. They must come to a certain level of experience, and by that level of experience, they must indeed fulfill the purpose of the great controversy. Until that great purpose has been achieved, the work of God can most certainly never be accomplished. I'm firmly convinced, as a result of the added light which has come to us during this year, that those who will be the 144,000 not only must determine to fulfill God's purpose through them, but they also must understand just what that purpose is. And understanding it, then walk in a pathway which, with God's help and guidance, will bring us to that particular point in our life's experience. For tonight now, I want to begin with some preliminary thoughts along these lines, and the first thing I want to reiterate is the evidence that we have most plainly that the end is coming and coming soon. The day is fast approaching when this work shall be accomplished. The people of God will fulfill the purpose of the great controversy in the hands of Christ, the great teacher and leader, and then the end will come. Now we're familiar, of course, with the many statements back in Great Controversy, page 457, 458, Evangelism in Desire of Ages and other places, where Sister White has so distinctly stated that if the people of God had been true and faithful way back there in the early 1840s, the work would soon have been completed and the end would have come and Christ would have returned to this sinful world again. But this hasn't happened because the people of God have not been faithful. Now I'd like to read a statement tonight which seems to contradict that, and let me underline the word seems to contradict it, because of course there's no true contradiction in the Word of God. I turn to the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, the Ellen G. White Comments, of course, not the human writings, volume 1, page 1092 and 1093. Here I read the following. I beg your pardon, just 1093, my mistake, it's not 1092 at all. 1093. In the days of Abraham, the Lord declared the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. He would not at that time allow them to be destroyed. In this is revealed the long-suffering of God. The Amorites were at enmity with God, were at enmity against his law. They believed not in him as a true and living God, but among them were a few good persons, and for the sake of these few, he forbore long. Centuries afterward, when the Israelites returned from Egypt to the promised land, the Amorites were cast out before the children of Israel. They finally suffered calamity because of continued willful disregard of the law of God. A statement originally appeared in Review and Herald, July 12, 1906. I read now, again from Review and Herald, this time May the 2nd, 1893, but found on page 1093 of Volume 1 of the Bible Commentary. The Amorites were inhabitants of Canaan, and the Lord had promised the land of Canaan to the Israelites. But a long interval must pass before his people should possess the land. He stated the reason why this interval must pass. He told them that the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full, and their expulsion and extermination could not be justified until they had filled up the cup of their iniquity. Idolatry and sin marked their course, but the measure of their guilt was not such that they could be devoted to destruction. In his love and pity, God would let light shine upon them in more distinct rays. He would give them opportunity to behold the working of his wondrous power, that there might be no excuse for their course of evil. It is thus that God deals with the nations. Through a certain period of probation, he exercises long-suffering toward nations, cities, and individuals. But when it is evident that they will not come unto him that they might have life, judgments are visited upon them. A time came when judgment was inflicted upon the Amorites, and a time will come when all the transgressors of his law will know that God will by no means clear the guilty. I think you're familiar with the statement in Volume 5 where Sister White speaks along these same lines. Now, the children of Israel came first of all to Kadesh Barnea, as you recall, back in the days of ancient Israel at their wilderness wanderings. And they did not go into the land of Canaan because, among other reasons, the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. Well, then we may say that one may charge God with bringing the Israelites up there falsely at that time and giving them a false promise of going in, and so organizing things that they did not go in till a later point of time. Likewise, you might say, inasmuch as today the iniquity of the nations is not yet full, that God has given us a false promise when he said that the people of God might have gone in way back in the early 40s and 50s. But what we have to understand is the two ways by which the work of God can be finished. There are two ways. We have to understand, and this is the most important point which will emerge even more fully as the week goes by, that the righteousness of the people of God is a powerful influence in the world which is going to bring the world rapidly to a point of righteousness also, or contrariwise, will drive the world rapidly into a deeper depth of sin. In other words, whenever righteousness appears at its best, sin is going to appear at its worst. And that's a principle that we must keep well in mind. Now, for instance, let's give some examples of this. If we go back to the experience of Jesus Christ, now, before he came to this world, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were a ministry in Israel which were regarded with great respect and adoration by the people. And outwardly, they were venerable men, honest, noble, true, very pious, very righteous, and so on. And they didn't go around persecuting people and crucifying folk and all those kind of things. It just didn't happen. But there came a time when Jesus Christ, as the perfect embodiment of the righteousness of God, stood amongst them as the light of this world. And of course, we know that those proud men refused to accept him and his ministry amongst them. And what do we find the reaction being on their part? Did they simply stand still where they were? Or do we find that they began to go downhill very rapidly and to manifest the most evil characteristics imaginable? The answer is clear, isn't it? In other words, you can't stand still. When light comes to a person, the living principles of God's truth, then it's impossible for you to reject that light and stand where you did before and retain what you had before. You can't do that. As truly as you can't rest on your oars in the stream and expect to stand still, you're going to drift downstream as certainly as can be. And so it was as we see the progression of Christ's life upon this earth. As day by day he lived the life of God in human flesh, as day by day the revelation of God's righteousness was revealed to mankind, what did the Pharisees do? They became worse and worse and worse. And the more righteously Jesus lived, if I can use the word more righteously, because of course Christ didn't live more righteously at all, his righteousness was perfect all the time, but he lived more righteously in the sense that he grew and developed in power and strength. His influence broadened and widened, and as a result of that, he, in that sense of the word, lived more righteously as he went down toward the end of his life's ministry. And as Christ progressed toward the cross, and those Pharisees met that righteousness head on day by day, what do we find becoming of their iniquity? It rapidly grew worse and worse and worse. Isn't that true? Rapidly. Until at the cross of Calvary, we see righteousness at its very best, the greatest manifestation of the unselfishness of God that history could provide, and at that same point, we see iniquity at its very worst. Now therefore, if the Seventh-day Adventist Church during the 1840s, 50s, and 60s had gone on in righteousness, then what would have rapidly developed so far as the world was concerned? It's iniquity. Now, I'd like now to turn to the great controversy, and read here from the chapter entitled The Impending Conflict, this fact. The page is 587. I'll go back to page 586 and pick up the thought from there along these lines. The iniquity and spiritual darkness that prevailed under the supremacy of Rome were the inevitable result of her suppression of the scriptures. But where is to be found the cause of the widespread infidelity, the rejection of the law of God, and the consequent corruption under the full blaze of gospel light in an age of religious freedom? Now that Satan can no longer keep the world under his control by withholding the scriptures, he resorts to other means to accomplish the same object. To destroy faith in the Bible serves his purpose as well as to destroy the Bible itself, by introducing the belief that God's law is not binding. He as effectually leads men to transgress as if they were wholly ignorant of its precepts. And now, as in former ages, he has worked for the church to further his designs. A sentence worth noticing, isn't it? Now, as in former ages, he works for the church to further his designs. The religious organizations of the day have refused to listen to unpopular truths plainly brought to view in the scriptures. And in combating them, they have adopted interpretations and taken positions which have sown broadcast the seeds of skepticism. clinging to the papal error of natural immortality and man's consciousness in death, they have rejected the only defense against the delusions of spiritualism. The doctrine of eternal torment has led many to disbelieve the Bible. And as the claims of the fourth commandment are urged upon the people, it is found that the observance of the seventh day is enjoined, and is the only way to free themselves from a duty which they are unwilling to perform, many popular teachers declare that the law of God is no longer binding. Thus they cast away the law and the Sabbath together. As the work of Sabbath reform extends, this rejection of a divine law to avoid the claims of the fourth commandment will become well nigh universal. The teachings of religious leaders have opened the door to infidelity, to spiritualism, and to contempt for God's holy law. And upon these leaders rests a fearful responsibility for the iniquity that exists in the Christian world. Let's go back a moment now and just analyze the words found in that particular paragraph. If we take ourselves back to the days before 1844, we'll recognize that back then the Protestant churches were quite strong in teaching the law of God. Men like Wesley and the other preachers before 1844 were strong in that respect. But when those churches came to 1844, there came to them the first, the second, and the third angel's messages. And this revealed light. In fact, each message brought more light beyond that which was revealed by the previous angel. And as the churches refused to accept the light which God sent to them, we find that they're forced to retreat from the true positions which they already held. Because particularly mentioned there in that paragraph is the fact that the great Sabbath truth was part of that glorious light which was revealed to the churches back at that time. And in order to reject the Sabbath truth, a very, very unpopular message so far as they were concerned, they were forced to the position where they said, well, the law has been done away with. Because if they should say the law is still binding, then what's going to happen so far as the Sabbath is concerned? They're going to have to keep it. In fact, a few days ago there was related to me an experience of one of our brethren. And he told how when he was a young man, he listened one day to a very, very fine radio sermon on the Ten Commandments, given by a preacher up in Washington. The church he belonged to, I just don't know. And when the sermon was over, he telephoned to the minister's home who'd given the sermon over the radio, but the man wasn't in. It having been a tape recorded study, but his wife was there. And so he said to her, I appreciated very much the sermon that was given this morning over the radio, and I would like to especially thank your husband for emphasizing the fact that the Ten Commandments must be kept. With great fervor, the minister's wife said to him, whatever you do, she said, don't ever let anybody tell you that the Ten Commandments are not to be obeyed. Never. Well, that's fine, he said, I'm glad to hear you say that. But what puzzles me, he said, is the fourth commandment. Or, she said, you don't have to keep that one at all. That's not obligatory. Well, now, he said, you have got me confused. Because a moment ago you said that I was to let nobody tell me the Ten Commandments were not to be obeyed. And now you turn around and tell me that the fourth commandment doesn't have to be kept. He said, that's very puzzling. I don't know what to do now. Well, the poor lady was in a bit of a box, and she said, well, she said, I'd better let my husband explain this to you. He'll be coming in later, and when he comes in, I'll have him telephone you and explain how this all is. Well, our brother gave her his telephone number and said he'd be home the rest of the day and each evening throughout the week, and he says after 25 or 30 years, he's still waiting to hear from that minister, understandably. In other words, any preacher in the Protestant world today who declares that the Ten Commandments are still binding upon God's people will find themselves at once in an impossible dilemma, in an unanswerable position, in a position where they can be cornered and embarrassed and forced to do one thing or the other. And so it was then that the Protestant churches were forced to retreat from the light which they already had, that is, the great truth that they believed the law of God was binding upon them, when to hold that position meant they must keep the seventh day Sabbath. So therefore, when they rejected the Sabbath truth, then they had to retreat from that which they already had as a principle of life, that you cannot, you just simply cannot reject light which God brings to you without losing something of that which you already have. It's impossible. As surely as you do that, you go back. How often we see the sad story in history of how people have said, well, we are the people of God, we have the light of God. See how nobly I stood for the seventh day Sabbath and for the doctrine of the immortality of the soul and this truth and that truth, how I've been persecuted and so forth and so on. I've stood for all that. And yet when added light comes, because God's truth never stands still, unless the people of God have refused to go on with it, God's truth never stands still. When added light inevitably comes, they say, no, I'll reject that. And as surely as they do, they go back downhill again. Now, as Sister White says here, the rejection of the law of God has opened the door for the inflowing of, what's the word? Infidelity, which of course is unbelief, atheism, to spiritualism, and to contempt for God's holy law. And that has opened the door for the iniquity which abounds in the world today. Now, to make matters worse, that class of people who see this thing happening in the world, and let's bear in mind the fact that the church is in the world for only one purpose. The church is in the world to save the world. Now, don't misunderstand me here. I don't mean that the church is the savior of the world. Christ is the savior of the world, but what I mean is the church is there as the instrument through which salvation shall flow to the earth. She is to be the channel. She is to be the custodian of the truth. She is to carry the truth to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. And one has only to look back in the history of the past to see what a tremendous impact just one life can have, or if you wish, a group of people or a church filled with people. Take a look, for instance, at the life of Elijah and see what an impact that one man had upon the generation of his day. Had that one man stood there face to face with the king of Israel and the priests of Baal, and succeeded in cleansing the whole of Israel from that idolatrous Baal worship of those priests, and how he literally turned the history of Israel round about face. What if Elijah had not been there, and there'd been nobody else to be an Elijah? What then? It'd been a tragic situation. God would have had no voice to speak through, no man through whom to work. And look too at the impact of the life of Jesus Christ upon human history, through the impact of the Apostolic Church, through the impact of the Reformation, and you think of the fact that the freedom we enjoy today, the enlightenment we have today, knowledge of God's truth we have today, is due to the mighty impact of the Protestant Reformation. If that had never been, where would we be at the present time? Think about it. It would be a frightening thought, wouldn't it? Now, if then just one lone man, such as Christ or Elijah, or a church such as the Apostolic Church or the Reformation Church could make the impact upon their society which they did, then what can we justifiably expect the churches of today to do if they have the truth of God? Why? To uplift society. To be a morally purifying influence. To be a cleansing power. But you know, if you go back, shall we say 20 years to 1950, and at that time, as we recognized, the churches were, well, downhill so far as respectability and popularity was concerned. They were poor in this world's goods, had limited membership, and were pretty dead upon their feet. Then came the great names of Billy Graham and such men as these, and the church began to rise enormously in power, in prestige, and in popularity. If we go back to the same year, 1950, and begin at the same point with another graph, and draw now a line indicating the rise of lawlessness, iniquity, immorality, and that kind of thing in the world, what do we find? That grows even faster than does the power of the church. Now, is that the kind of picture you ought to see? Of course it's not. We should find instead that the line of iniquity should go down, or at least lessen considerably, and of course, really it should go down and become less and less and less instead of becoming more and more and more. Now, this naturally, of course, is an embarrassment, even though unspoken, so far as the churches are concerned. And they have to come up with an answer, because they're supposed to have the answers, and this is the answer which they're going to give more and more as time goes by. I read now on page 587 of great controversy still. Yet this very class put forth the claim that the fast spreading corruption is largely attributable to the desecration of the so-called Christian Sabbath, and that the enforcement of Sunday observance would greatly improve the morals of society. This claim is especially urged in America, where the doctrine of the true Sabbath has been most widely preached. By whom? The Seventh-day Adventist Church. So in America, where the truth of God has been most widely preached, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church has been most powerful and widespread, this is where the iniquity is at its worst as a direct consequence of the rejection of the fourth commandment. Very good. Now we have seen so far that the rejection of the fourth commandment has brought in the fearful iniquity which we see in the world today. All right then. Now notice that there's nothing that fails like failure. And the very people who have rejected the law and have brought in this iniquity now turn around and say, under a cloak of religion, that this iniquity is due to the desecration of Sunday. Now, what is, and that of course is to uphold Sunday, and to uphold Sunday is to further reject what? The Sabbath, isn't it? It's a further rejection of the Sabbath, which is a further rejection of the law, which, as we can see here now, is a further rejection of the law of God. And what's that going to result in? More iniquity, and still more iniquity, as we have this circle now, which is rejection, followed by greater iniquity, followed by greater rejection, followed by greater iniquity, and so it goes on. And of course the circle is not just round and round, it's a spiral which is going in what direction? Down, 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 to that point of time when the iniquity of the Amorites will be full. Now, the point I'm anxious for you to see as I read these pages here in great controversy is this, that the present state of the world is due to its rejection of the truth sent to her from heaven. And the measure of that rejection and the measure of that iniquity is in direct proportion to the power of the presentation of the truth of God. You see that point? In other words, when the Seventh-day Adventist Church was preaching the truth of God in the power of the Spirit, she made a mighty contribution to the hastening of the end of time. And today, the world is coasting on, as you might say, in the momentum given to it by that preaching in the latter half of the last century. Now, if when they were faithful, they accomplished as much as they did, and have brought things to the point to which they have come, then how much more rapidly would the end have come if they had continued to give to the world the impetus which they had been giving in the last century. And this is a point that I hope you folk can see and clearly grasp, because it undergirds a great deal of what we're going to say during the coming days of this week. Now, this explains then how it is that the iniquity of the Amorites, which of course is the present day world, must come to its full before the end can come, because God will not dispossess the world while there are still some people in it who have honest hearts and can be drawn to Him. That's not, just not going to be done. And God will not dispossess the world until they have come to the fullness of iniquity and merit and bring upon their own heads, because God destroys nobody, as Sister White plainly tells us in Volume 5, and bring this thing upon their heads, and then of course the end can come and the purpose of the great controversy can be achieved. Now this means then that by and large, this way of finishing the work has failed. But instead of the church going on and on in righteousness and thus forcing the world to go more and more in wickedness to the point where any honest soul in the world would gladly come out and take the truth, the Adventist church has dropped off from that work and even joined with the world, and therefore her impact has ceased to exist so far as the world is concerned. In fact, I read just a few weeks ago a statement by, I just forgotten his name, never a famous... a famous modern German church leader. This German church leader addressed himself to the Seventh-day Adventist Church and said there was a time, he said, when the preaching of the Seventh-day Adventist Church on the nearness of Christ's return, of the validity of the Sabbath commandment, was something which caused us great concern and stirred us in opposition against that kind of teaching. But, he said, I must confess that day has passed, and no longer does the preaching of the Seventh-day Adventist Church disturb us in any sense of the word at all. And that I thought was a very penetrating commentary from a church leader in the Protestant world from the great nation of Germany. Stated just a few months ago, I must get hold of the exact statement from his lips in English, because I had to translate it from German myself, which wasn't too easy even for me to do. Now, but now the point is this, the next point is this, we understand that today we are the custodians of the truth of God. We understand that. Otherwise we wouldn't be here in this room tonight. Unless, of course, we come as a new face to investigate and to hear what it's all about. And now the question must be raised, how much impact upon the world does this little company of believers around the world have? None. Absolutely none. Well, perhaps I shouldn't say absolutely none, but so little it doesn't amount to anything very much at all. We recognize from the study of the prophecies of John the Baptist, Elijah, from the study of the 10 virgins, that we are like John the Baptist in the wilderness, preparing for a work which is yet to be done. And as you remember, John the Baptist spent those 30 solid years of preparation, during which time, how much impact did his life have upon the generation of his day? Practically none. Maybe an odd individual here and there was influenced by his life and teachings and ministry as he prepared day by day, but by and large, the impact of John's life was negligible during those 30 years. Was this part of God's plan? God knew the work that John the Baptist was to do. God understood that to do that work there had to be a most thorough preparation. And so John was taken out to school, out in the wilderness, away from human society, which he only visited at odd intervals to observe and see what was going on. And then at the end of the 30 years, John came out at God's call, and for only a bare 7, 8, or 9 months at the most, John made an active contribution to the work of the finishing of the gospel. 30 years of preparation for so short a time. And yet how vital in the overall program that work was. And like John the Baptist today, our impact upon the world is negligible. It doesn't amount to anything. But this doesn't mean the end is not going to come. Because there's a second way in which the work of God can be finished, and that second way is this, that left to itself, the world must and will come to the fullness of iniquity. The only difference is it takes a little longer, that's all. But that time is coming with a rapidity today which is frightening. You folk, of course, living in America, aware of the moral condition of this country. It's bankrupt. Today the slogan is, anything goes and everything goes, and there are no more taboos, no more barriers, no more restraints, no more discipline. What I want, I get. What I want, I have, is the attitude of old and young across the land today. Not all, of course, feel that way. Many of the older ones are deeply concerned by what's going on and are doing their best to stem the tide. Just like a man trying to hold back a mob of galloping horses, stampeding horses. He just hasn't got a hope, and eventually the ones who are trying are going to be overrun. Now, naturally, of course, in my travels, I can't avoid passing in and out of some of the largest cities in the world. For instance, I was in Frankfurt in Germany, in Copenhagen in Denmark, Oslo in Norway, in Hamburg and Berlin, in the last few weeks as far as Europe is concerned, and in America I haven't been actually in the big cities excepting for the airports, which of course are not really an indication of what the city is like. And you know how it is that when you have a child growing up in your own home, you're not aware of the growth when you're living beside that child day by day. But should someone come and see the child this year and go away for 12 months and come back again, their first remark will be, oh, hasn't that child grown? And your answer will be, well, do you think so? Now he remembers what he was like 12 months ago. He comes back and sees the child as he is today. And the difference, of course, is striking and very evident. As I've traveled through the cities of Europe over the past 7 years, made eight visits to Europe in the last 7 years, I have discerned over the first 6 of those years a steady and marked declension in the moral condition of the country. Now, I'd like to emphasize here, I don't go around looking for these things particularly, but as you know, there are some things you just can't help but see. They stare you in the face as you go down the street. There they are, and I will of course state this, I don't close my eyes either, because I am concerned to keep my eyes on the developments of things and try and keep a tab on the progression of the preparedness of this world for the last closing scenes. And I've become accustomed over the past 6 years of my visit to Europe in seeing this kind of pattern, which was slowly increasing in steepness and severity. But I wasn't prepared for the things I saw this year without going to look for them. And I was startled by a picture which is like this now, where no longer are we going down slowly, but now we are going down vertically in what you might say is the last power dive of human civilization. Have we passed any hope of this world ever turning about and recovering itself? That day is long since gone. The hearts of men today are set irretrievably on disaster, and that disaster is coming. And I wouldn't care to repeat to you people the things that I become aware that exist in the moral world so far as Europe is concerned, and likewise things which are happening here in America too. Things which a few years ago were done in secret, but were done, today are being done openly, flagrantly, boldly, and completely unashamedly. And without question, the time is when the world is rapidly retrogressing so far as moral and spiritual worth is concerned. Of course, you folk here in America are well aware of the condition of the land so far as the unrest of the youth are concerned, the bombings, the riotings, the kidnappings, the hijackings, and all these things which are going on, where men have cast aside every moral restraint and every spiritual restraint and are bent only upon having their own selfish, willful ways, irrespective of the cost of other people. Imagine dynamiting 4 or 5 magnificent jetliners, just blowing them up wantonly and willfully, and in just one moment destroying $45 or more million worth of material. That's just sheer irresponsibility. But these folk reap their reward, and the time is rapidly coming when the figures shall be full and the end will come. And when that time comes, the great river Euphrates will be dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now, on the other hand, the equally striking witness of this year has been these two things. The onward march of this message. More and more light is coming, and we're going to find as we meet together at this camp meeting and study God's word together, under the tutelage of His Spirit, we're going to see things that we've never, ever seen before. And if we are in tune with God, our hearts will be warmed, wonderfully warmed, by what we shall see and understand of the truth for this time. I feel very sorry for people who get bogged down, if I may use that expression, over some petty and trivial little personal problem, and thus fail to keep pace with the advancing light. It's marching on, and it will march on. It won't delay nor tarry. And our business, of course, is to keep pace with that light and not become stragglers and be left out by the way. If we do, we shall have only ourselves to blame. You can't hurt the truth of God and the movement of God. It marches on. And our task is to keep pace with it. And together with that, as I mentioned a little before, the striking thing that I have seen around the world today is the way in which God is unifying His people. We have been beset over the past 10 years, as we were very much preoccupied with last year, of course, with the presence in our midst of disgruntled people who have been trying to impose their will upon the movement at large. And every one of those men and women, as the case may be today, has passed away from our midst, or at least I trust they have. And this year, in the various camp meetings so far, we have been singularly free from any such kind of influence, any such kind of influence whatsoever. There's been a unity of thoughts, a unity of feeling, a unity of fellowship, a unity of mind and heart, which is something born not from any human planning, but from above. It's something which has left me awed and amazed and thankful to God that this is so. You know, we don't preach unity. We never have. You've never heard us giving studies on unity in the meetings which we've given here during the past 7 years or 6 years since I first came to America. This is my 7th visit, covering 6 years since 1964 and 1970. And some of you folk, I think, have heard the message right back in those first meetings. Others, of course, have come in a little later. And we haven't gone around preaching to you, unify, unify, unify. But Jesus said, sanctify them to thy truth, that they all may be what? One. In other words, unity is not the root. Unity is the fruit. And if you were to get fruit on a tree, then you don't go around tying apples on a thorn bush. But rather, you concentrate on getting the tree into its place, and when the tree is there, what's going to follow? The fruit. And likewise, if you want to get unity, and we want that so badly because we know it's the prerequisite of the latter rain, that we must first of all preach the message of sanctification. Because by preaching that, we lay the groundwork that's going to result in the receiving of the truth for this time. And as we preach sanctification, that is the root which is going to produce the fruit of what? Unity, as surely as can be. And so while I say we've never preached a sermon on unity, I guess we should truthfully say we've never preached anything else, have we? Because as you preach the root, the fruit must follow. And so, as I said, it's been the striking thing around the world today that God has been at work purifying his people. And those folk who've had a spirit out of tune with the spirit of this message have found themselves sifted and cleansed out of the camp of Israel. And let every person in this room tonight face the very sober truth that those who have been sifted out in the God's direction and leading, and we best leave them just where they are. I'll never forget how down in Australia, I think it was last year, we had one or two troublemakers in the camp, people that we had to speak to and with and plead with to mend their ways, and who stubbornly refused to do that, who carried their grudges and their murmuring spirit. And we came to the place where, understanding the prophecy of Egypt for Canaan, we knew the time had come for God to cleanse the camp of murmurers. And we knelt down in prayer meeting, and we prayed to God to fulfill the prophecy and cleanse the camp of these influences which were retarding the work and bringing in a wrong spirit and atmosphere. And then we trusted God to do that. And we suppose God did that very thing. Those folk withdrew themselves from our midst, and while we were very sorry to see them go in one sense, in another sense we were glad that their influence was no longer amongst us, and the blessings of God have been multiplied amongst his people from that time on. The one dear soul who had a high profession of love for perishing souls went out and tried to drag in again these disgruntled elements, which to our mind was a very sad thing, because when God does something, then we're not to work against the work of God. And if God cleanses out of the camp unruly elements, what's our business? Let them be where they are. For instance, when Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rebelled against the truth of God, what did Moses say to the people? He said, separate yourselves from these people, didn't he? And God expected them to do that. And those who didn't separate themselves from those rebels, what happened to them? They perished with them. And this too, of course, we have seen as the year has gone by. Witness after witness reveals the work of God amongst these people at the present time. There is a new unity amongst us. There is a new sense of God's abiding presence. There is a new and wonderful understanding of his truth. And I'd give anything to be able to put all you folk in my suitcase and take you around the world with me and let you see for yourselves the things I'm saying tonight. It encourages you enormously. It encourages my heart, and I can't tonight speak with anything else but courage and hope and confidence in this matter. Now I say in conclusion, and I'd appeal to any person, I can't read your hearts of course, any person who this year has come to this camp bearing any kind of a residue of an old murmuring spirit or a complaining spirit, go to God and get rid of it. For your sake, for God's sake, for the truth's sake, for the sake of all the great multitudes sleeping in the tomb who are waiting so patiently for the 144,000 to finish that final work and see the end come. This is a time for deep soul searching, a time for the closest possible examination of ourselves, a time for faithful prayer and high expectation, a time to come to camp meeting when we can expect to know that God will work amongst us in power during this coming week. And I just pray and trust tonight that each one of us will sense the hour to which we have come, and especially as these studies progress during this week, and there comes the unfolding of that role that must be fulfilled by God's people in the end, that we shall be solemnized to a deeper consecration, and that we shall go forth in these meetings knowing that God has walked and talked with us, has walked amongst us, and has better fitted us for the great and final and finishing work which lies ahead. And so I trust that each one of us will make very thorough work of heart preparation tonight. And during the coming days of this week, let's determine that we shall be individually a blessing this week in this camp meeting. Let's put away any differences we have amongst ourselves, if there are any. Pardon me. anything which stands between us and God, let's determine that our lives shall be a blessed contribution to the success of this camp meeting. Because I can stand up here all week and preach the most wonderful sermon, far better than I actually do. I could talk with the tongue of men and of angels. But if our hearts are bearing anything that will shut out Jesus, then I shall speak in vain. Isn't that true? And again, every person in this room can be having the most wonderful blessing. But if my heart isn't in tune with God, then the Holy Spirit can be falling on hearts all around me. And what about it? I shall neither discern it nor receive it. So if you don't go away blessed from this camp meeting, then don't blame anybody else but who? Yourselves. And so I just trust that these few thoughts tonight, these introductory thoughts which lay down something of the picture as things stand in this old world and in the Church of God, a picture which reveals that we are very close to the heavenly harbour, very close to the end for which we so long waited and prayed, will be to us an inspiration, a challenge, and will lead us to a very deep personal consecration to serve God this week with our whole heart and mind and spirit. And may God bless us each one tonight, and may you all have a very blessed Sabbath day.